Welcome to the Reality Revolution. I'm your host, Brian Scott. I'm always excited to return to Carlos Castaneda. We've repeatedly discussed the mysteries behind Castaneda and some of the unusual circumstances of his life in previous episodes. We've read from his wonderful book, The Art of Dreaming, and we've explored the shadows world, the assemblage point, and we've also discussed recapitulation on another episode. While some of this information is obviously distorted, some of it is very powerful, and one of the most powerful things from Carlos Castaneda is a concept of recapitulation, which is discussed by other Toltec teachers and sorcerers. This information is super powerful and is specifically related to your energy system. Also, the discussion of the dark sea of awareness is really fascinating. In reality trance surfing, we talk about the space of variations, which may be an easier way of looking at it, or the void, or the quantum field, but this dark sea of awareness that Don Juan refers to in the Carlos Castaneda works is where the assemblage point connects, and the description and understanding of energy and experience is very powerful in here, and you get an understanding of infinity as it relates to Don Juan and this process that the sorcerers were going through so that they could live in infinity, in the active side of infinity, in which is where the information I'm getting this particular episode from, a book called The Active Side of Infinity, where he first brings up the concepts of recapitulation as well as others. Castaneda begins by saying, "I was in Don Juan's house in Sonora." For those of you that are first hearing about Carlos Castaneda for the very first time, Don Juan is a Toltec sorcerer, a Yaqui Indian, who teaches Carlos Castaneda the ways of sorcery, and he is referred to in all of the books that Castaneda wrote. Some people claim that he may not be true, and some claim that he may be, and in fact may be a conglomeration of a number of characters. It's also possible he changed the name of someone else that he actually was working with. Any one of these are true, but there is some resonance from his information related to actual Yaqui Indian Toltec teachings, which are related. Castaneda had been asleep in Don Juan's house in Sonora, sound asleep in my bed, Castaneda said, when he woke me up. I'd stayed up practically all night, mulling over concepts that he had explained to me. "You have rested enough," he said firmly, almost gruffly, as he shook me by the shoulders. "Don't indulge in being fatigued. Your fatigue is more than fatigue, a desire not to be bothered. Something in you resents being bothered, but it's most important that you exacerbate that part of you until it breaks down. Let's go for a hike." Don Juan was right. There was some part of me that resented immensely being bothered. I wanted to sleep for days and not think about Don Juan's sorcery concepts anymore. Thoroughly against my will, I got up and followed him. Don Juan had prepared a meal which I devoured as if I hadn't eaten for days, and then we walked out of the house and headed east toward the mountains. I had been so dazed that I hadn't noticed that it was early morning until I saw the sun, which was right above the eastern range of mountains. I wanted to comment to Don Juan that I had slept all night without moving, but he hushed me. He said that we were going to go on an expedition to the mountains to search for specific plants. "What are you going to do with the plants you are going to collect, Don Juan?" I asked him as soon as we had started off. "They are not for me," he said with a grin. "They are for a friend of mine, a botanist and pharmacist. He makes potions with them." "Is he a Yaqui, Don Juan? Does he live in Sonora?" I asked. "No, he isn't a Yaqui, and he doesn't live here in Sonora. You'll meet him someday." "Is he a sorcerer, Don Juan?" "Yes, he is," he replied dryly. I asked him then if I could take some of the plants to be identified at the botanical garden at UCLA. "Surely, surely," he said. I had found out in the past that whenever he said surely, he didn't mean it. It was obvious he had no intention whatsoever of giving me any specimens for identification. I became very curious about his sorcerer friend and asked him to tell me more about him, perhaps describe him, telling me where he lived and how he got to meet him. "Whoa, whoa, whoa," Don Juan said, as if I were a horse. Hold it, hold it. Who are you? Professor Lorca, do you want to study his cognitive system? We went deep into the arid foothills. Don Juan walked steadily for hours. I thought that the task of the day was going to be just to walk. He finally stopped and sat down on the shaded side of the foothills. It is time that you start on one of the biggest projects of sorcery, Don Juan said. What is this project of sorcery that you are talking about, Don Juan? I inquired. It's called the recapitulation, he said. The old sorcerers used to call it recounting the events of your life. And for them, it started as a simple technique, a device to aid them in remembering what they were doing and saying to their disciples. For their disciples, the technique had the same value. It allowed them to remember what their teachers had said and done to them. It took terrible social upheavals, like being conquered and vanquished several times, before the old sorcerers realized that their technique had far-reaching effects. Are you referring, Don Juan, to the Spanish conquest? I asked. No, he said. That was just the icing on the cake. There were other upheavals before that, more devastating than when the Spaniards got here, the old sorcerers didn't exist any longer. The disciples of those who had survived other upheavals were very cagey by then. They knew how to take care of themselves. It was that new crop of sorcerers who renamed the old sorcerer's technique, recapitulation. There's an enormous premium on time, he continued. For sorcerers in general, time is of the essence. The challenge I am faced with is that in a very compact unit of time, I must cram into you everything there is to know about sorcery as an abstract proposition. But in order to do that, I have to build the necessary space in you. What space? What are you talking about, Don Juan? The premise of sorcerers is that in order to bring something in, there must be a space to put it in, he said. If you are filled to the brim with items of everyday life, there's no space for anything new. That space must be built. Do you see what I mean? The sorcerers of olden times believed that the recapitulation of your life made that space. It does, and much more, of course. The way sorcerers perform the recapitulation is very formal, he went on. It consists of writing a list of all the people they have met from the present to the very beginning of their lives. Once they have that list, they take the first person on it and recollect everything they can about that person. And I mean everything, every detail. It's better to recapitulate from the present to the past because the memories of the present are fresh. And in this manner, the recollection ability is honed. What practitioners do not recollect and breathe, they inhale slowly and deliberately, fanning the head from right to left in a barely noticeable swing and exhale in the same fashion. He said that inhalations and exhalations should be natural. If they were too rapid, one would enter into something he called tiring breaths, breaths that require slower breathing afterward in order to calm down the muscles. And what do you want me to do, Don Juan, with all this? I asked. You begin making your list today, he said. Divide it by years, by occupations. Arrange it in any order you want, but make it sequential, with the most recent person first and end with mommy and daddy, and then remember everything about them. No more ado than that. As you practice, you'll realize what you're doing. On my next visit to his house, I told Don Juan that I had been meticulously going through the events of my life, and that it was very difficult for me to adhere to his strict format and follow my list of persons one by one. Ordinarily, my recapitulation took me every which way. I let the events decide the directions of my recollection. What I did, which was volitional, was to adhere to a general unit of time. For instance, I had begun with the people in the anthropology department, but I let my recollection pull me to anywhere in time from the present to the day I started attending school at UCLA. I told Don Juan that an odd thing I'd found out, which I had completely forgotten, which was that I had no idea that UCLA existed until one night when my girlfriend's roommate from college came to Los Angeles and we picked her up at the airport. She was going to study musicology at UCLA. Her plane arrived in the early evening and she asked me if I could take her to the campus so she could take a look at the place where she was going to spend the next 4 years of her life. I knew where the campus was, for I had driven past its entrance on Sunset Boulevard endless times on my way to the beach. I had never been on the campus, though. It was during the semester break. Few people that we found directed us to the music department. Campus was deserted, but what I witnessed subjectively was the most exquisite thing I've ever seen. It was a delight to my eyes. The building seemed to be alive with some energy of their own. What was going to be a very cursory visit to the music department turned out to be a gigantic tour of the entire campus. I fell in love with UCLA. I mentioned to Don Juan that the only thing that married my ecstasy was my girlfriend's annoyance at my insistence on walking through the huge campus. "What the hell could there be in here?" she yelled at me in protest. "It's as if you have never seen a university campus in your life. You've seen one. You've seen them all. I think you're just trying to impress my friend with your sensitivity." I wasn't, and I vehemently told them I was genuinely impressed by the beauty of my surroundings. I sensed so much hope in those buildings, so much promise, and yet I couldn't express my subjective state. "I've been in school nearly all my life," my girlfriend said through clenched teeth, "and I'm sick and tired of it. Nobody's going to find shit in here. All you find is guff, and they don't even prepare you to meet your responsibilities in life." When I mentioned that I would like to attend school here, she became even more furious. "Get a job," she screamed. "Go and meet life from 8 to 5 and cut the crap. That's what life is, a job from 8 to 5, 40 hours a week. See what it does to you. Look at me, I'm super educated now, and I'm not fit for a job." All I knew was that I had never seen a place so beautiful. I made a promise that I would go to school at UCLA, no matter what, come hell or high water. My desire had everything to do with me, and yet it was not driven by the need for immediate gratification. It was more in the realm of awe. I told Don Juan that my girlfriend's annoyance had been so jarring to me that it forced me to look at her in a different light. And that to my recollection, that was the first time that a commentary had aroused such a deep reaction in me. I saw facets of character in my girlfriend that I hadn't seen before, facets that scared me stiff. "I think I judged her terribly," I said to Don Juan. After our visit to the campus, we drifted apart. It was as if UCLA had come between us like a wedge. I know that it's stupid to think this way. "It isn't stupid," Don Juan said. "It was a perfectly valid reaction. While you were walking on the campus, I am sure that you had a bout with intent. You intended being there, and anything that was opposed to it, you had to let go." "But don't overdo it," he went on. "The touch of warrior traveler is very light. Although it is cultivated, the hand of a warrior traveler begins as a heavy gripping iron hand, but becomes like the hand of a ghost, a hand made of gossamer. Warrior travelers leave no marks, no tracks. That's the challenge for warrior travelers." Don Juan's comments made me sink into a deep, morose state of recriminations against myself, for I knew from the little bit of my recounting that I was extremely heavy-handed, obsessive, and domineering. I told Don Juan about my ruminations. "The power of the recapitulation," Don Juan said, "is that it stirs up all the garbage of our lives and brings it to the surface." Then Don Juan delineated the intricacies of awareness and perception, which were the basis of the recapitulation. He began by saying that he was going to present an arrangement of concepts that I should not take as sorcerer's theories under any conditions, because it was an arrangement formulated by the shamans of ancient Mexico as a result of seeing energy directly as it flows in the universe. He warned me that he would present the units of this arrangement to me without any attempt at classifying them or ranking them by any predetermined standard. "I'm not interested in classifications," he went on. "You've been classifying everything all your life. Now you're going to be forced to stay away from classifications. The other day when I asked you if you knew anything about clouds, you gave me the names of all the clouds and the percentage of moisture that one should expect from each one of them. You were a verifiable weatherman. When I asked you if you knew what you could do with the clouds personally, you had no idea what I was talking about. Classification have a world of their own," he continued. "After you began to classify anything, the classification becomes alive and it rules you. But since classifications never started as energy-giving affairs, they always remain like dead logs. They are not trees, they are merely logs." He explained that the sorcerers of ancient Mexico saw that the universe at large is composed of energy fields in the form of luminous filaments. They saw zillions of them wherever they turned to see. They also saw that those energy fields arrange themselves into currents of luminous fibers, streams that are constant, perennial forces in the universe, and that the current or stream of filaments that is related to the recapitulation was named by those sorcerers the Dark Sea of Awareness, and also the Eagle. He stated that those sorcerers also found out that every creature in the universe is attached to the Dark Sea of Awareness at a round point of luminosity that was apparent when those creatures were perceived as energy. On that point of luminosity, which the sorcerers of ancient Mexico called the assemblage point, Don Juan said that perception was assembled by a mysterious aspect of the Dark Sea of Awareness. Don Juan asserted that on the assemblage point of human beings, zillions of energy fields from the universe at large in the form of luminous filaments converge and go through it. These energy fields are converted into sensory data, and the sensory data is then interpreted and perceived as the world we know. Don Juan further explained that what turns the luminous fibers into sensory data is the Dark Sea of Awareness. Sorcerers see this transformation and call it the glow of awareness, a sheen that extends like a halo around the assemblage point. He warned me that he was going to make a statement which, in the understanding of sorcerers, was central to comprehending the scope of the recapitulation. Putting an enormous emphasis on his words, he said that what we call the senses in organisms is nothing but degrees of awareness. He maintained that if we accept that the senses are the Dark Sea of Awareness, we have to admit that the interpretation that the senses make of sensory data is also the Dark Sea of Awareness. He explained at length that to face the world around us in the terms that we do is the result of the interpretation system of mankind with which every human being is equipped. He also said that every organism in existence has to have an interpretation system that permits it to function in its surroundings. The sorcerers who came after the apocalyptic upheavals I told you about, he continued, saw that at the moment of death, the Dark Sea of Awareness sucked in, so to speak, through the assemblage point, the awareness of living creatures. They also saw that the Dark Sea of Awareness had a moment, let's say, hesitation when it was faced with sorcerers who had done a recounting of their lives. Unbeknownst to them, some had done it so thoroughly that the Dark Sea of Awareness took their awareness in the form of their life experiences but didn't touch their life force. Sorcerers had found out a gigantic truth about the forces of the universe. The Dark Sea of Awareness wants only our life experiences, not our life force. The premises of Don Juan's elucidation were incomprehensible to me, or perhaps it would be more accurate to say I was vaguely and yet deeply cognizant of how functional the premises of his explanation were. Sorcerers believe, Don Juan went on, that as we recapitulate our lives, all the debris, as I told you, comes to the surface. We realize our inconsistencies, our repetitions, but something in us puts up a tremendous resistance to recapitulating. Sorcerers say that the road is free only after a gigantic upheaval, after the appearance on our screen of the memory of an event that shakes our foundations with its terrifying clarity of detail. It's the event that drags us to the actual moment that we lived it. Sorcerers call that event the usher, because from then on, every event we touch on is relived, not merely remembered. Walking is always something that precipitates memories. Don Juan went on, the sorcerers of ancient Mexico believed that everything we live, we store as a sensation on the backs of the legs. They considered the backs of the legs to be the warehouse of man's personal history. So let's go for a walk in the hills now. We walked until it was almost dark. I think I have made you walk long enough, Don Juan said when we were back at his house, to have you ready to begin this sorcerer's maneuver of finding an usher an event in your life that you will remember with such clarity that it will serve as a spotlight to illuminate everything else in your recapitulation with the same or comparable clarity. Do what sorcerers call recapitulating pieces of a puzzle. Something will lead you to remember the event that will serve as your usher. He left me alone, giving me one last warning. Give it your best shot, he said. Do your best. I was extremely silent for a moment, perhaps due to the silence around me. I experienced then a vibration, a sort of jolt in my chest. I had difficulty breathing, but suddenly something opened up in my chest that allowed me to take deep breath, and a total view of a forgotten event of my childhood burst into my memory. As if it had been held captive and was suddenly released, I was at my grandfather's studio where he had a billiard table and I was playing billiards with him. I was almost 9 years old then. My grandfather was quite a skillful player, and compulsively he had taught me every play he knew until I was good enough to have a serious match with him. We spent endless hours playing billiards. I became so proficient at it that one day I defeated him. From that day on, he was incapable of winning. Many a time I deliberately threw a game just to be nice to him, but he knew it and would become furious with me. Once he got so upset that he hit me on the top of the head with a cue. To my grandfather's chagrin and delight, by the time I was 9 years old, I could make a carom after carom without stopping. He became so frustrated and impatient in a game with me once that he threw down his cue and told me to play by myself. My compulsive nature made it possible for me to compete with myself and work with the same play on and on until I got it perfectly. One day, a man notorious in town for his gambling connections, the owner of a billiards house, came to visit my grandfather. They were talking and playing billiards as I happened to enter the room. I instantly tried to retreat, but my grandfather grabbed me and pulled me in. "This is my grandson," he said to the man. "Very pleased to meet you," the man said. He looked at me sternly and then extended his hand, which was the size of the head of a normal person. I was horrified. His enormous burst of laughter told me that he was cognizant of my discomfort. He told me that his name was Filelo Quiroga, and I mumbled my name. He was very tall and extremely well-dressed. He was wearing a double-breasted blue pinstriped suit with beautifully tapered trousers. He must have been in his early 50s then, but he was trim and fit except for a slight bulge in his midsection. He wasn't fat. He seemed to cultivate the look of a man who is well-fed and is not in need of anything. Most of the people in my hometown were gaunt. They were people who labored hard to earn a living and had no time for niceties. Filelo Quiroga appeared to be the opposite. His whole demeanor was that of a man who had time only for niceties. He was pleasant-looking, yet a bland, well-shaven face with kind blue eyes. He had the air and the confidence of a doctor. People in my town used to say he was capable of putting anyone at ease, and he should have been a priest, a lawyer, or a doctor instead of a gambler. They also used to say that he made more money gambling than all the doctors and lawyers in town put together made by working. His hair was black and carefully combed. It was obviously thinning considerably. He tried to hide his receding hairline by combing his hair over his forehead. He had a square jaw and an absolutely winning smile. He had big white teeth, which were all cared for, the ultimate novelty in an area where tooth decay was monumental. Two other remarkable features of Filelo Quiroga for me was his enormous feet and his handmade black patent leather shoes. I was fascinated by the fact that his shoes didn't squeak at all as he walked back and forth in the room. I was accustomed to hearing my grandfather's approach by the squeak of the soles of his shoes. "My grandson plays billiards very well," my grandfather said nonchalantly to Filelo Quiroga. "Why don't I give him my cue and let him play with you while I watch?" "The child plays billiards," the big man asked my grandfather with a laugh. "Oh, he does," my grandfather assured him. "Of course, not as well as you do, Filelo. Why don't you try him? And to make it interesting for you, so you won't be patronizing my grandson, let's bet a little money. What do you say if we bet this match?" He put a thick wad of crumpled up bills on the table and smiled at Filelo Quiroga, shaking his head from side to side as if daring the big man to take his bet. "Oh my, my, that much, Filelo Quiroga said, looking at me questioningly. He opened his wallet, then pulled out some neatly folded bills. This was, for me, another surprising detail. My grandfather's habit was to carry his money in every one of his pockets all crumpled up. When he needed to pay for something, he had to straighten out the bills in order to count them. Valello Quiroga didn't say it, but I knew that he felt like a highway robber. He smiled at my grandfather, and obviously out of respect for him, he put his money on the table. My grandfather, acting as the arbiter, set the game at a certain number of karams and flipped a coin to see who would start first. Quiroga won. "You better give it all you have without holding back," my grandfather urged him. "Don't have any qualms about demolishing this twerp and winning my money." Valello Quiroga, following my grandfather's advice, played as hard as he was able, but at one point he missed one karam by a hair. I took the cue. I thought I was going to faint, but seeing my grandfather's glee, he was jumping up and down, calmed me. And besides, it irked me to see Valello Quiroga about to split his sides laughing when he saw the way I held the cue. I couldn't lean over the table as billiards is normally played because of my height, but my grandfather, with painstaking patience and determination, had taught me an alternative way of playing by extending my arm all the way back. I held the cue nearly above my shoulders to the side. "What does he do when he has to reach the middle of the table?" Quiroga asked, laughing. "He hangs on the edge of the table," my grandfather said matter-of-factly. "It's permissible, you know." My grandfather came to me and whispered through clenched teeth that if I tried to be polite and lose, he was going to break all the cues on my head. I knew he didn't mean it. This was just his way of expressing his confidence in me. I won easily. My grandfather was delighted beyond description, but strangely enough, so was Valello Quiroga. He laughed as he went around the pool table, slapping its edges. My grandfather praised me to the skies. He revealed to Quiroga my best score and joked that I had excelled because he had found the way to lure me to practice coffee with Danish pastries. "You don't say, you don't say," Quiroga kept repeating. He said goodbye. My grandfather picked up the bet money and the incident was forgotten. My grandfather promised to take me to a restaurant and buy me the best meal in town, but he never did. He was very stingy. He was known to be a lavish spender only with women. 2 days later, two enormous men affiliated with Valello Quiroga came to me at the time that I got out from school and was leaving. "Valello Quiroga wants to see you," one of them said in a guttural tone. "He wants you to go to his place and have some coffee and Danish pastries with him." If he hadn't said coffee and Danish pastries, I probably would have run away from them. I remembered then that my grandfather had told Valello Quiroga that I would sell my soul for coffee and Danish pastries. I gladly went with them. However, I couldn't walk as fast as they did. So one of them, the one whose name was Guillermo Falcon, picked me up and cradled me in his huge arms. He laughed through crooked teeth. "You better enjoy the ride, kid," he said. His breath was terrible. "Have you ever been carried by anyone? Judging by the way you wriggle, never." He giggled grotesquely. Fortunately, Valello Quiroga's place was not too far from the school. Mr. Falcon deposited me on a couch in an office. Valello Quiroga was there, sitting behind a huge desk. He stood up and shook hands with me. He immediately had some coffee and delicious pastries brought to me, and the two of us sat there chatting amiably about my grandfather's chicken farm. He asked me if I would like to have more pastries, and I said that I wouldn't mind if I did. He laughed, and he himself brought me a whole tray of unbelievable, delicious pastries from the next room. After I had veritably gorged myself, he politely asked me if I would consider coming to his billiards place in the wee hours of the night to play a couple of friendly games with some people of his choice. He casually mentioned that a considerable amount of money was going to be involved. He openly expressed his trust in my skill and added that he was going to pay me for my time and my effort, a percentage of the winning money. He further stated that he knew the mentality of my family. They would have found it improper that he give me money, even though it was pay. So he promised to put the money in the bank in a special account for me, or more practical yet, he would cover any purchase that I made in any one of the stores in town or the food I consumed in any restaurant in town. I didn't believe a word of what he said. I knew that Valello Quiroga was a crook, a racketeer. I liked, however, the idea of playing billiards with people I didn't know, and I struck a bargain with him. "Will you give me some coffee and Danish pastries like the ones you gave me today?" I said. "Of course, my boy," he replied. "If you come to play for me, I will buy you the bakery. I will have the baker bake them just for you. I take my word." I warned Valello Quiroga that the only drawback was my incapacity to get out of my house. I had too many aunts who watched me like hawks, and besides, my bedroom was on the second floor. That's no problem, Philelo Quiroga assured me. You're quite small. Mr. Falcon will catch you if you jump from your window into his arms. He's as big as a house. I recommended that you go to bed early tonight. Mr. Falcon will wake you up by whistling and throwing rocks at your window. You have to watch out, though. He's an impatient man. I went home in the midst of the most astounding excitation. I couldn't go to sleep. I was quite awake when I heard Mr. Falcon whistling and throwing small pebbles against the glass panes of the window. I opened the window. Mr. Falcon was right below me on the street. Jump into my arms, kid, he said to me in a constricted voice, which he tried to modulate into a loud whisper. If you don't aim at my arms, I'll drop you and you'll die. Remember that. Don't make me run around. Just aim at my arms. Jump, jump. I did, and he caught me with the ease of someone catching a bag of cotton. He put me down and told me to run. He said that I was a child awakened from a deep sleep and that he had to make me run so I would be fully awake by the time I got to the billiards house. I played that night. Two men and I won both games. I had the most delicious coffee and pastries that one could imagine. Personally, I was in heaven. It was around 7 in the morning when I returned home. Nobody had noticed my absence. It was time to go to school for all the practical purposes. Everything was normal except for the fact that I was so tired that I couldn't keep my eyes open all day. From that day on, Philelo Quiroga sent Mr. Falcon to pick me up 2 or 3 times a week, and I won every game that he made me play. And faithful to his promise, he paid for anything that I bought, including meals at my favorite Chinese restaurant where I used to go daily. Sometimes I even invited my friends, whom I mortified no end by running out of the restaurant screaming when the waiter brought the bill. They were amazed at the fact they were never taken to the police for consuming food and not paying for it. What was an ordeal for me was that I had never conceived of the fact that I would have to contend with the hopes and expectations of all the people who bet on me. The ordeals of ordeals, however, took place when a crack player from a nearby city challenged Philelo Quiroga and backed his challenge with a giant bet. The night of the game was an inauspicious night. My grandfather became ill and couldn't fall asleep. The entire family was in an uproar. It appeared that nobody went to bed. I doubted that I had any possibility of sneaking out of my bedroom, but Mr. Falcon's whistling and the pebbles hitting the glass of my window were so insistent that I took a chance and jumped from my window into Mr. Falcon's arms. It seemed that every male in town had congregated at the billiards place. Anguished faces silently begged me not to lose. Some of the men boldly assured me that they had bet their houses and all their belongings. One man, in a half-joking tone, said that he had bet his wife. If I didn't win, he would be a cuckold that night or a murderer. He didn't specify whether he meant he would kill his wife in order to not be a cuckold or me for losing the game. Philelo Quiroga paced back and forth. He had hired a masseur to massage me. He wanted me relaxed. The masseur put hot towels on my arms and wrists and cold towels on my forehead. Put on my feet the most comfortable, soft shoes that I had ever worn. They had hard military heels and arch supports. Quiroga even outfitted me with a beret to keep my hair from falling into my face, as well as a pair of loose overalls with a belt. Half of the people around the billiard table were strangers from another town. They glared at me. They gave me the feeling they wanted me dead. Quiroga flipped a coin to decide who would go first. My opponent was a Brazilian of Chinese descent, young, round-faced, very spiffy and confident. He started first, and he made a staggering amount of caroms. I knew by the color of his face that Philelo Quiroga was about to have a heart attack, and so were the other people who had bet everything they had on me. I played very well that night, and as I approached the number of caroms the other man had made, the nervousness of the ones who had bet on me reached its peak. Philelo Quiroga was the most hysterical of them all. He yelled at everybody and demanded that someone open the windows because the cigarette smoke made the air unbreathable for me. He wanted the masseur to relax my arms and shoulders. Finally, I had to stop everyone, and in a real hurry, I made the 8 caroms that I needed to win. The euphoria of those who had bet on me was indescribable. I was oblivious to all that, for it was already morning, and they had to take me home in a hurry. My exhaustion that day knew no limits. Very obligingly, Quiroga didn't send me for a whole week. However, one afternoon, Mr. Falcon picked me up from school and took me to the billiards house. Kuroga was extremely serious. He didn't even offer me coffee or Danish pastries. He sent everybody out of his office and got directly to the point. He pulled his chair close to me. "I put a lot of money in the bank for you," he said very solemnly. "I am true to what I promised you. I give you my word that I will always look after you. You know that? Now, if you do that, what I'm going to tell you to do, you'll make so much money that you won't have to work a day in your life. I want you to lose your next game by 1 krone. I knew that you can do it, but I want you to miss by only a hair. The more dramatic, the better." I was dumbfounded. All of this was incomprehensible to me. Lelo Kuroga repeated his request and further explained he was going to bet anonymously all he had against me, and that was the nature of our new deal. "Mr. Falcon has been guarding you for months," he said. "All I need to tell you is that Mr. Falcon uses all his force to protect you, but he could do the opposite with the same strength." Lelo Kuroga's threat couldn't have been more obvious. He must have seen in my face the horror that I felt, for he relaxed and laughed. "Oh, but don't you worry about things like that," he said reassuringly, "because we are brothers." This was the first time in my life I've been placed in the untenable position I wanted with all my might to run away from Falelo Kuroga, from the fear that he had evoked in me. But at the same time, and with equal force, I wanted to stay. I wanted the ease of being able to buy anything I wanted from any store, and above all, the ease of being able to eat at any restaurant of my choice without paying. I was never confronted, however, with having to choose one or the other. Unexpectedly, at least for me, my grandfather moved to another area, quite distant. It was as if he knew what was going on, and he sent me ahead of everyone else. I doubted that he actually knew what was taking place. It seemed that sending me away was one of his usual intuitive actions. Don Juan's return brought me out of my recollection. I lost track of time. I should have been famished, but I wasn't hungry at all. I was filled with nervous energy. Don Juan lit a kerosene lantern and hung it from a nail on the wall. Its dim light cast strange dancing shadows in the room. It took a moment for my eyes to adjust to the semi-darkness. I entered then into a state of profound sadness. It was a strangely detached feeling of far-reaching longing that came from that semi-darkness, or perhaps from the sensation of being trapped. I was so tired that I wanted to leave, but at the same time, with the same force, I wanted to stay. Don Juan's voice brought me a measure of control. He appeared to know the reason for and the depth of my turmoil and modulated his voice to fit the occasion. The severity of his tone helped me to gain control over something that could easily have turned into a hysterical reaction to fatigue and mental stimulation. "To recount events is magical for sorcerers," he said. "It isn't just telling stories. It is seeing the underlying fabric of events. This is the reason recounting is so important and vast." At his request, I told Don Juan the event I had recollected. "How appropriate," he said, and chuckled with delight. "The only commentary I can make is that warrior travelers roll with the punches. They go wherever the impulse may take them. The power of warrior travelers is to be alert, to get maximum effect from minimal impulse, and above all, their power lies in not interfering. Events have a force, a gravity of their own, and travelers are just travelers. Everything around them is for their eyes alone. In this fashion, travelers construct the meaning of every situation without ever asking how it happened this way or that way. Today you remembered an event that sums up your total life," he continued. "You're always faced with a situation that is the same as the one that you never resolved. You never really had to choose whether to accept or reject Falelo Quiroga's crooked deal. Infinity always puts us in this terrible position of having to choose," he went on. "We want infinity, but at the same time, we want to run away from it. You want to tell me to go and jump in a lake, but at the same time, you are compelled to stay. It would be infinitely easier for you to just be compelled to stay. The interplay of energy on the horizon." The clarity of the usher brought a new impetus to my recapitulation. A new mood replaced the old one. From then on, I began to recollect events in my life with maddening clarity. It was exactly as if a barrier had been built inside me that had kept me holding rigidly on to meager and unclear memories, and the usher had smashed it. My memory faculty had been, for me prior to that event, a vague way of referring to things that had happened, but which I wanted most of the time to forget. Basically, I had no interest whatsoever in remembering anything of my life. Therefore, I honestly saw absolutely no point in this futile exercise of recapitulating, which Don Juan had practically imposed on me. For me, it was a chore that tired me instantly and did nothing but point out my incapacity for concentrating. I had dutifully made, nevertheless, lists of people, and I had engaged in a haphazard effort of quasi-remembering my interactions with them. My lack of clarity in bringing these people into focus didn't dissuade me. I fulfilled what I considered to be my duty, regardless of the way I really felt. With practice, the clarity of my recollection improved. I thought remarkably I was able to descend, so to speak, on certain choice events with a fair amount of keenness that was at once scary and rewarding. After Don Juan presented me with the idea of the usher, however, the power of my recollection became something for which I had no name. Following my list of people made the recapitulation extremely formal and exigent, the way Don Juan wanted it. From time to time, something in me got loose, something that forced me to focus on events unrelated to my list, events whose clarity was so maddening that I was caught and submerged in them, perhaps even more intensely than I had been when I had lived the experiences themselves. Every time I recapitulated in such a fashion, I had a degree of detachment which allowed me to see things I had disregarded when I had really been in the throes of them. First time in which the recollection of an event shook me to my foundations happened after I had given a lecture at a college in Oregon. The students in charge of organizing the lecture took me and another anthropology friend of mine to a house to spend the night. I was going to go to a motel, but they insisted for our comfort on taking us to this house. They said that it was in the country and there was no noises, the quietest place in the world with no telephones, no interference from the outside world. I, like the fool that I was, agreed to go with them. Don Juan had not only warned me to always be a solitary bird, he had demanded that I observe his recommendations, something that I did most of the time, but there were occasions when the gregarious creature in me took the upper hand. The committees took us to the house quite a distance from Portland, of a professor who was on sabbatical. Very swiftly, they turned on the lights inside and outside of the house, which was located on a hill with spotlights all around it. But the spotlights on the house must have been visible for 5 miles away. After that, the committee took off as fast as they could, something that surprised me because I thought they were going to stay and talk. The house was a wooden A-frame, small but very well constructed. It had an enormous living room and mezzanine above it, where the bedroom was. Right above, at the apex of the A-frame, there was a life-size crucifix hanging from a strange rotating hinge, which was drilled into the head of the figure. The spotlights on the wall were focused on the crucifix. It was quite an impressive sight, especially when it rotated, squeaking as if the hinge needed oil. The bathroom of the house was another sight. It had mirrored tiles on the ceiling, the walls, and the floor, and was illuminated with a reddish light. There was no way to go to the bathroom without seeing yourself from every conceivable angle. I enjoyed all those features of the house, which seemed to me stupendous. When the time came for me to go to sleep, however, I encountered a serious problem, because there was only one narrow, hard, quiet, monastic bed, and my anthropologist friend was close to having pneumonia, wheezing and retching phlegm every time he coughed. He went straight for the bed and passed out. I looked for a place to sleep. I couldn't find one. That house was barren of comforts. Besides, it was cold. The committee had turned on the lights, but not the heater. I looked for the heater. My search was fruitless, as was my search for the switch to the spotlights, or to any of the lights in the house, for that matter. The switches were there on the walls, but they seemed to be overruled by the effect of the main switch. The lights were on, and I had no way to turn them off. The only place I could find to sleep was on a thin throw rug, and the only thing I found with which I could cover myself was the tanned hide of a giant French poodle. Obviously, it had been the pet of the house and had been preserved. It had shiny black marble eyes and an open mouth, with the tongue hanging out. I put the head of the poodle's skin toward my knees. I had to cover myself with tanned rear end, which was on my back. Its preserved head was like a hard object between the knees, quite unsettling. If it had been dark, it wouldn't have been as bad. I gathered a bundle of washcloths and used them as a pillow. I used as many as possible to cover the hide of the French poodle the way I could. I couldn't sleep at all. It was then as I lay there cursing myself silently for being so stupid and not following Don Juan's recommendation that I had the first maddeningly clear recollection of my entire life. I'd recollected the events that Don Juan had called the usher with equal clarity, but my tendency had always been to half disregard what happened to me when I was with Don Juan on the basis that in his presence anything was possible. This time, however, I was alone. Years before I met Don Juan, I had worked painting signs on buildings. My boss's name was Luigi Palma. One day, Luigi got a contract to paint a sign advertising the sale and rental of bridal gowns and tuxes on the back wall of an old building. The owner of the store in the building wanted to catch the eye of possible customers with a large display. Luigi was going to paint a bride and groom, and I was going to do the lettering. We went to the flat roof of the building and set up a scaffold. I was quite apprehensive, although I had no overt reason to be so. I'd painted dozens of signs on high buildings. Luigi thought I was beginning to be afraid of heights, but that my fear was going to pass. When the time came to start working, he lowered the scaffold a few feet from the roof and jumped onto its flat boards. He went to one side while I stood on the other in order to be totally out of his way. He was the artist. Luigi began to show off. His painting movements were so erratic and agitated that the scaffold moved back and forth. I became dizzy. I wanted to go back on the flat roof, using the pretext that I needed more paint and other painter's paraphernalia. I grabbed the edge of the wall that fringed the flat roof and tried to hoist myself up, but the tips of my feet got stuck in the boards of the scaffold. I tried to pull my feet and the scaffold toward the wall. The harder I pulled, the farther away I pushed the scaffold from the wall. Instead of helping me untangle my foot, Luigi sat down and braced himself with the cords that attached the scaffold to the flat roof. He crossed himself and looked at me in horror. From his sitting position, he knelt weeping quietly as he recited the Lord's Prayer. I held onto the edge of the wall for dear life. What gave me the desperate strength to endure was that the certainty that if I was in control, I could keep the scaffold from moving further and further away. I wasn't going to lose my grip and fall 13 floors to my death. Luigi, being a compulsive taskmaster to the bitter end, yelled to me in the midst of tears that I should pray. He swore that both of us were going to fall to our deaths, and the least we could do was to pray for the salvation of our souls. For a moment, I deliberated about whether it was functional to pray. I opted to yell for help. People in the building must have heard my yelling and sent for the firemen. I sincerely thought it had taken only 2 or 3 seconds after I began to yell for the firemen to come onto the roof and grab Luigi and me and secure the scaffold. In reality, I had hung on to the side of the building for at least 20 minutes. When the firemen finally pulled me onto the roof, I had lost any vestige of control. I vomited on the hard floor of the roof, sick to my stomach from fear and the odious smell of melted tar. It was a very hot day. The tar on the cracks of the scratching roofing sheets was melting in the heat. The ordeal had been so frightening and embarrassing that I didn't want to remember it, and I ended up hallucinating that the firemen had pulled me into a warm yellow room. They had then put me in a supremely comfortable bed, and I had fallen peacefully asleep, safe, wearing my pajamas, delivered from danger. My second recollection was another blast of incommensurable force. I was talking amiably to a group of friends when, for no apparent reason I could account for, I suddenly lost my breath under the impact of a thought, a memory which was vague for an instant and then became an engrossing experience. Its force was so intense that I had to excuse myself and retreat for a moment to a corner. My friends seemed to understand my reaction. They disbanded without any comments. What I was remembering was an incident that had taken place in my last year of high school. My best friend and I used to walk to school passing a big mansion with a black wrought iron fence, at least 7 feet high and ending in pointed spikes. Behind the fence was an extensive, well-kept green lawn and a huge ferocious German Shepherd dog. Every day we used to tease the dog and let him charge at us. He stopped physically at this wrought iron fence, but his rage seemed to cross over to us. My friend delighted in engaging the dog every day in a contest of mind over matter. He used to stand a few inches from the dog's snout, which protruded between the iron bars at least 6 inches into the street, and bare his teeth, just like the dog did. "Yield, yield," my friend shouted every time. "Obey, obey, I am more powerful than you." His daily displays of mental power, which lasted at least 5 minutes, never affected the dog, outside of leaving him more furious than ever. My friend assured me daily as part of his ritual that the dog was either going to obey him or die in front of us of heart failure brought about by rage. His conviction was so intense that I believed that the dog was going to drop dead any day. One morning, when we came around, the dog wasn't there. We waited for a moment, but he didn't show up. Then we saw him at the end of the extensive lawn. He seemed to be busy, so we slowly began to walk away. From the corner of the eye, I noticed the dog was running at full speed toward us. When he was perhaps 6 or 7 feet from the fence, he took a gigantic leap over it. I was sure he was going to rip his belly off the spikes. He barely cleared them and fell onto the street like a sack of potatoes. I thought for a moment that he was dead, but he was only stunned. Suddenly he got up, and instead of chasing after the one who had brought about his rage, he ran after me. I jumped onto the roof of a car, but the car was nothing for the dog. He took a leap and was nearly on top of me. I scrambled down and climbed the first tree that was within reach, a flimsy little tree that could barely support my weight. I was sure that it would snap in the middle, sending me right into the dog's jaws to be mauled to death. In the tree, I was nearly out of his reach, but the dog jumped again and snapped his teeth, catching me by the seat of my pants and ripping them. His teeth actually nicked my buttocks. The moment I was safe at the top of the tree, the dog left. He just ran up the street, and perhaps looking for my friend. At the infirmary in school, the nurse told me that I had to ask the owner of the dog for a certificate of rabies vaccination. "You must look into this," she said severely. "You may have rabies already. If the owner refuses to show you the vaccination certificate, you are within your rights to call the police." I talked to the caretaker of the mansion where the dog lived. He accused me of luring the owner's most valuable dog, a pedigreed animal, out onto the street. "You better watch out, boy," he said in an angry tone. "The dog got lost. The owner will send you to jail if you keep on bothering us." "But I may have rabies," I said in a sincerely terrified tone. "I don't care if you have the bubonic plague," the man snapped. "Scram!" "I'll call the police," I said. "Call whoever you like," he retorted. "You call the police, we'll turn them against you. In this house, we have enough clout to do that." I believed him, so I lied to the nurse and said the dog could not be found, that it had no owner. "Oh my God," the woman exclaimed. "Then brace yourself for the worst. I may have to send you to the doctor." She gave me a long list of symptoms that I should look for or wait for until they manifested themselves. She said that the injections for rabies were extremely painful and they had to be administered subcutaneously on the area of the abdomen. "I wouldn't wish that treatment on my worst enemy," she said, plunging me into a horrid nightmare. What followed was my first real depression. I just lay in my bed feeling every one of the symptoms enumerated by the nurse. I ended up going to the school infirmary and begging the woman to give me the treatment for rabies, no matter how painful. I made a huge scene. I became hysterical. I didn't have rabies, but I had totally lost my control. I related to Don Juan my two recollections in all their detail, sparing nothing. He didn't make any comments. He nodded a few times. "In both recollections, Don Juan," I said, feeling myself the urgency of my voice. I was hysterical as anyone could be. My body was trembling. I was sick to my stomach. I don't want to say it was as if I were in the experiences, because that's not the truth. I was in the experiences themselves both times. And when I couldn't take them anymore, I jumped into my life now. For me, that was a jump into the future. I had the power of going over time. My jump into the past was not abrupt. The event developed slowly, as memories do. It was at the end that I did jump abruptly into the future, my life now. "Something in you has begun to collapse for sure," he finally said. "It has been collapsing all along, but it repaired itself very quickly every time its supports failed. My feeling is that it is now collapsing totally." After another long silence, Don Juan explained that the sorcerers of ancient Mexico believed that as he had told me already, we had two minds, and only one of them was truly ours. I had always understood Don Juan as saying that there were two parts to our minds, and one of them was always silent because expression was denied to it by the force of the other part. Whatever Don Juan had said, I had taken as a metaphysical way to explain perhaps the apparent dominance of the left hemisphere of the brain over the right, or something of the like. There is a secret option to the recapitulation, Don Juan said. Just like I told you, there is a secret option to dying, an option that only sorcerers take. In the case of dying, the secret option is that human beings could retain their life force and relinquish only their awareness, the product of their lives. In the case of the recapitulation, the secret option that only sorcerers take is to choose to enhance their true minds. The haunting memory of your recollections, he went on, could come only from your true mind. The other mind that we all have and share is, I would say, a cheap model, economy strength, one size fits all. But this is a subject that we will discuss later. What is at stake now is the advent of a disintegrating force, but not a force that is disintegrating you. I don't mean it in that way. It is a disintegrating what the sorcerers call the foreign installation, which exists in you and in every other human being. The effect of the force that is descending on you, which is disintegrating the foreign installation, is that it pulls sorcerers out of their syntax. I'd listened carefully to Don Juan, but I couldn't say that I had understood what he had said. For some strange reason, which was to me as unknown as the cause of my vivid recollections, I couldn't ask him any questions. I know how difficult it is for you, Don Juan said all of a sudden, to deal with this facet of your life. Every sorcerer that I know has gone through it. The males go through it, suffer infinitely more damage than the females. I suppose it's the condition of women to be more durable. The sorcerers of ancient Mexico, acting as a group, tried their best to buttress the impact of this disintegrating force. In our day, we have no means of acting as a group, so we must brace ourselves to face in solitude a force that will sweep us away from language, for there is no way to describe adequately what is going on. Don Juan was right in that I was at a loss for explanations or ways of describing the effect those recollections had on me. Don Juan had told me that sorcerers face the unknown in the most common incidents one can imagine. When they are confronted with it and cannot interpret what they are perceiving, they have to rely on an outside source for direction. Don Juan had called that source infinity, or the voice of the spirit, and had said that if sorcerers don't try to be rational about what can't be rationalized, the spirit unerringly tells them what's what. Don Juan had guided me to accept the idea that infinity was a force that had a voice and was conscious of itself. Consequently, he had prepared me to be ready to listen to that voice and act efficiently always, but without antecedents, using as little as possible the railings of the a priori. I waited impatiently for the voice of the spirit to tell me the meaning of my recollections, but nothing happened. I was in a bookstore one day when a girl recognized me and came over to talk to me. She was tall and slim and had an insecure little girl's voice. I was trying to make her feel at ease when I was suddenly accosted by an instantaneous energetic change. It was as if an alarm had been triggered in me, and as it happened in the past without any volition on my part whatsoever, I recollected another completely forgotten event in my life. The memory of my grandparents' house flooded me. It was a veritable avalanche so intense that it was devastating, and once more I had to retreat to my corner. My body shook as if I had taken a chill. I must have been 8 years old. My grandfather was talking to me. He had begun by telling me that it was his utmost duty to set me straight. I had two cousins who were my age, Alfredo and Luis. My grandfather demanded mercilessly that I admit that my cousin Alfredo was really beautiful. In my vision, I heard my grandfather's raspy, constricted voice. Alfredo doesn't need any introductions, he said to me on that occasion. He needs only to be present and the doors will fly open for him, because everybody practices the cult of beauty. Everybody likes beautiful people. They envy them, but they certainly seek their company. Take it from me, I am handsome, wouldn't you say? I sincerely agreed with my grandfather. He was certainly a very handsome man, small boned, with laughing blue eyes and an exquisitely chiseled face with beautiful cheekbones. Everything seemed to be perfectly balanced in his face and his nose, his mouth, his eyes, his pointed jaw. He had blonde hair growing on his ears, a feature that gave him an elf-like appearance. He knew everything about himself, and he exploited his attributes to the maximum. Women adored him, first according to him for his beauty, and second because he posed no threat to them. He of course took full advantage of all of this. "Your cousin Alfredo is a winner," my grandfather went on. "He will never have to crash a party because he'll be the first one on the list of guests. Have you ever noticed how people stop in the street to look at him and how they want to touch him? He's so beautiful that I'm afraid he's going to turn out to be an a-hole, but that's a different story. Let us say he'll be the most welcome a-hole you ever meet." My grandfather compared my cousin Luis with Alfredo. He said that Luis was homely, a little bit stupid, but that he had a heart of gold. And then he brought me into the picture. "If we are going to proceed with our explanation," he continued, "you have to admit in sincerity that Alfredo is beautiful and Luis is good. Now let's take you. You are neither handsome nor good. You're a veritable son of a bitch. Nobody's going to invite you to a party. You'll have to get used to that idea that if you want to be at a party, you have to crash it. Doors will never open for you the way they will open for Alfredo for being beautiful and for Luis being good. So you will have to get in through the window." His analysis of his three grandsons was so accurate, it made me weep with the finality of what he had said. The more I wept, the happier he became. He finished his case with the most deleterious admonition. "There's no need to feel bad," he said, "because there's nothing more exciting than getting in through the window. To do that, you have to be clever and on your toes. You have to watch everything and be prepared for endless humiliations. If you have to go in through the window," he went on, "it's because you are definitely not on the list of guests. Therefore, your presence is not welcome at all, so you have to work your butt off to stay. The only way I know is by possessing everybody. Scream, demand, advise, make them feel that you are in charge. How could they throw you out if you're in charge?" Remembering this scene caused profound upheaval in me. I had buried this incident so deeply that I had forgotten all about it. What I had remembered all along, however, was his admonition to be in charge, which he must have repeated to me over and over throughout the years. I didn't have a chance to examine this event or ponder it because another forgotten memory surfaced with the same force. In it, I was with the girl I had been engaged to. At that time, both of us were saving money to be married and have a house of our own. I heard myself demanding that we have a joint checking account. I wouldn't have it any other way. I felt an imperative need to lecture her on frugality. I heard myself telling her where to buy her clothes and what the top affordable price should be. Then I saw myself giving driving lessons to her youngest sister and going veritably berserk when she said she was planning to move out of her parents' house. Forcefully, I threatened her with canceling my lessons. She wept, confessing that she was having an affair with her boss. I jumped out of the car and began kicking the door. However, that was not all. I heard myself telling my fiancé's father not to move to Oregon where he planned to go. I shouted at the top of my voice that it was a stupid move. I really believed that my reasonings against it were unbeatable. I presented him with budget figures in which I had meticulously calculated his losses. When he didn't pay any attention to me, I slammed the door and left, shaking with rage. I found my fiancé in the living room playing her guitar. I pulled it out of her hands and yelled at her, and she embraced the guitar instead of playing it, as if it were more than an object. My desire to impose my will extended all across the board. I made no distinctions. Whoever was close to me was there for me to possess and mold, following my whims. I didn't have to ponder anymore the significance of my vivid visions, for an unquestionable certainty invaded me, as if coming from outside me. It told me that my weak point was the idea that I had to be the man in the director's chair at all times. It had been a deeply ingrained concept with me that I not only had to be in charge, but I had to be in control of any situation. The way in which I had been brought up had reinforced this drive, which must have been arbitrary at its onset, but had turned in my adulthood into a deep necessity. I was aware beyond any doubt what was at stake was infinity. Don Juan had portrayed it as a conscious force that deliberately intervenes in the lives of sorcerers, and now it was intervening in mine. I knew that infinity was pointing out to me through the vivid recollection of these forgotten experiences, the intensity and the depth of my drive for control, and thus preparing me for something transcendental to myself. I knew with frightening certainty that something was going to bar any possibility of my being in control, and that I needed more than anything else sobriety, fluidity, and abandon in order to face the things that I felt were coming to me. Naturally, I told this to Don Juan, elaborating to my heart's content on my speculations and inspirational insights about the possible significance of my recollections. Don Juan laughed good-humoredly. "All this is psychological exaggeration on your part, wishful thinking," he said. "You are, as usual, seeking explanations with linear cause and effect. Each of your recollections becomes more and more vivid, more and more maddening to you because, as I told you already, you have entered an irreversible process. Your true mind is emerging, waking up from a state of lifelong lethargy. Infinity is claiming you," he continued. "Whatever means it uses to point that out to you cannot have any other reason, any other cause, any other value than that. What you should do, however, is to be prepared for the onslaught of infinity. You must be in a state of continuous bracing yourself for a blow of tremendous magnitude. This is the sane, sober way in which sorcerers face infinity." Don Juan's words left me with a bad taste in my mouth. I actually sensed the assault coming on me and feared it. Since I had spent my entire life hiding behind some superfluous activity, I immersed myself in work. I gave lectures and classes taught by my friends in different schools in Southern California. I wrote copiously. I could say without exaggeration that I threw dozens of manuscripts into the garbage can because they didn't fulfill any indispensable requirement that Don Juan had described to me as the mark of something that is acceptable by infinity. He had said that everything I did had to be an act of sorcery, an act free from encroaching expectations, fears of failures, hopes of success, free from the cult of me. Everything I did had to be impromptu, a work of magic where I freely opened myself to the impulses of the infinite. One night, I was sitting at my desk preparing myself for my daily activity of writing. I felt a moment of grogginess. I thought that I was feeling dizzy because I had gotten up too quickly from my mat where I had been doing my exercises. My vision blurred. I saw yellow spots in front of my eyes. I thought I was going to faint. The fainting spell got worse. There was an enormous red spot in front of me. I began to breathe deeply, trying to quiet whatever agitation was caused this visual impenetrable darkness. The thought crossed my mind that I had fainted. However, I could feel the chair, my desk. I could feel everything around me from inside the darkness that surrounded me. Don Juan had said that the sorcerers of his lineage considered that one of the most coveted results of inner silence was a specific interplay of energy, which is always heralded by a strong emotion. Experience this interplay. Such an interplay manifested itself in terms of hues that were projected on any horizon in the world of everyday life, be it a mountain, the sky, a wall, or simply the palms of the hands. He'd explained that this interplay of hues begins with the appearance of a tenuous brushstroke of lavender on the horizon. In time, this lavender brushstroke starts to expand until it covers the visible horizon, like advancing storm clouds. He assured me that a dot of a peculiar rich pomegranate red shows up as if bursting from the lavender clouds. He stated that as sorcerers become more disciplined and experience, the dot of pomegranate expands and finally explodes into thoughts or visions. Or in the case of a literate man, into written words. Sorcerers either see visions engendered by energy, hear thoughts being voiced as words, or read written words. That night at my desk, I didn't see any lavender brushstrokes, nor did I see any advancing clouds. I was sure that I didn't have the discipline that sorcerers require for such an interplay of energy, but I had an enormous dot of pomegranate red in front of me. This enormous dot, without any preliminaries, exploded into disassociated words that I read as if they were on a sheet of paper coming out of a typewriter. The words moved at such tremendous speed in front of me that it was impossible to read anything. Then I heard a voice describing something to me. Again, the speed of the voice was wrong for my ears. The words were garbled, making it impossible to hear anything that would make sense. As if that weren't enough, I began to see liverish scenes like one sees in dreams after a heavy meal. They were baroque, dark, ominous. I began to twirl, and I did so until I got sick to my stomach. The whole event ended there. I felt the effect of whatever had happened to me in every muscle of my body. I was exhausted. This violent intervention had made me angry and frustrated. I rushed to Don Juan's house to tell him about this happening. I sensed that I needed his help more than ever. "There's nothing gentle about sorcerers or sorcery," Don Juan commented after he heard my story. "This was the first time that infinity descended on you in such a fashion. It was like a blitz. It was a total takeover of your faculties. Insofar as the speed of your visions is concerned, you yourself will have to learn to adjust it. For some sorcerers, that's the job of a lifetime. But from now on, energy will appear to you as if it were being projected onto a movie screen. Whether or not you understand the projection," he went on, "is another matter. In order to make an accurate interpretation, you need experience. My recommendation is that you shouldn't be bashful and you should begin now. Read energy on the wall. Your true mind is emerging and it has nothing to do with the mind that is a foreign installation. Let your true mind adjust the speed. Be silent and don't fret no matter what happens." "But Don Juan, is all this possible? Can one actually read energy as if it were a text?" I asked, overwhelmed by this idea. "Of course it's possible," he retorted. "In your case, it's not only possible, it's happening to you. But why reading it as if it were a text?" I insisted. But it was rhetorical insistence. "It's an affectation on your part," he said. "If you read the text, you could repeat it verbatim. However, if you tried to be a viewer of infinity instead of a reader of infinity, you could find that you would not describe whatever you were viewing, and you could end up babbling inanities, incapable of verbalizing what you witness. The same thing if you tried to hear it. This is, of course, specific to you. Anyway, infinity chooses. The warrior traveler simply acquiesces to the choice. But above all," he added, after a calculated pause, "don't be overwhelmed by the event because you cannot describe it. It is an event beyond the syntax of our language." So that's just a couple chapters from the book Active Side of Infinity, and there's so much more. We can definitely come back to it. I know that you might have been bored by portions of this reading, because essentially it's Carlos Castaneda going into a memory. But in doing so, I wanted you to go about the process and understanding of recapitulation. It's similar to reframing, but different. I did do a meditation which was reframing and recapitulation previously. I will try to dedicate a meditation just to recapitulation and separate those. But it is a very powerful process. Sometimes people say, don't focus on the past, don't focus on the future, just stay in the present. But you're many times very much hindered by your past. And if you're not dealing with it, then it's pushed deep into your subconscious mind. And more importantly, it's taking away from your essence, your soul energy. It's very similar to the meditation I have on recovering your soul fragments. When you have really focused on certain events, especially the ones that are emotional, as he points out, they were felt in his body, then you almost leave a fragment of your soul in that place in time. It becomes an experience that the dark sea of awareness sort of eats, and that is its food. It doesn't eat your soul energy, though. And so if you've gone through the process of experiencing these things as if it's happening in the last moments, then it can really change your life. In my book, I talk about my own experience where I felt like I was about to die. Somebody had shot me. In that moment, I began to have my life flash before my eyes. Memories of my kids, of my childhood. It seems like this thing that happens in the final moments of your life. And all those memories would have just been food, and I would have been put back into this cycle of recurrence. And in many cases, perhaps dealing with the issues that were caused by these recapitulations. So it's sort of karmic for you to go through these memories, play them out, and then let the energy of it go. The process will make sense once you just make a list of people in your life and start going through memories, and they'll start popping up, very much like what experience that Carlos Castaneda is describing. When I went through my recapitulation, it was very much like what he did. You just have these things that start to come up in your mind, and you deal with them, become aware of them. And in some cases, as he did, you become aware of their impact on your life, even though Don Juan sort of laughs it off. We will definitely come back to this some more, but it helps you to visualize and understand the importance of it. And I don't think the dark sea of awareness is necessarily eating our memories and that it's a negative or terrible thing. The dark sea of awareness is just naturally doing that. Perhaps that is the beginnings of the social memory complex, but there's a portion of your energy that is yours. You can retain it, kind of give it away as you sit in past incidents, because your soul is fragmented. It's the best way I can explain. He says in here that the sorcerers could see the energy. In particular, they could see the energy of people when they die, and they could see that the dark sea of awareness, or the eagle they called it, would take away all of the experiences, but not the soul energy. And that sorcerers had gone through the process of recapitulating, had essentially taken away the energy of these experiences, and they weren't giving away the energy of these experiences. Seems kind of complicated, but it really isn't. And it could be just naturally a good thing for you to do, go back over your past. In any case, I would love to get your opinions on this if you've gone through the recapitulation process. I have discussed it in another episode. I just wanted to discuss it in the sort of fictionalized way that Carlos Castaneda discusses it, in the way he describes remembering experiences. If you have events in your past, that you may have some things that have happened in your past that are hidden away, that you're not aware of. When you bring them up, it's an energy that you are putting towards this thing. So you may have deep memories that you can bring about into your conscious layer and then release the energy attachment that you have to them. And all these energies then come back to your aura. And so you have a larger amount of life force. And that's the most important realization that I've had from it. So I'd love to get your opinions on this. There is an aspect of the Carlos Castaneda that can be somewhat negative. I do not think that there's negative to this, but you could always look for it. You'll always find what you look for. In any case, I'm sending out light and love to everyone on your journey to find infinity. You can always find any episode of The Reality Revolution at therealityrevolution.com, and welcome to The Reality Revolution.